I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In his State of the State address last week, Governor Phil Scott pointed out that the nation's economic gains have not made it to many parts of Vermont. Especially outside of Chittenden County, many Vermonters are seeing themselves slide backwards.
Across our state, proud communities and the people who call them home have yet to benefit from economic recovery. From the Northeast Kingdom to the Marble Valley, from the Canadian border to the shores of the Connecticut River, from Richford to Reedsboro, Rochester to Reigate, the small towns and regional economic centers that helped build our state are stuck in an economic cycle they did not create. And as a result, far too many of our neighbors find themselves in a place they can no longer afford.
Vermont's poverty rate has been on the rise in the last 10 years, even as some other states pulled out of the Great Recession. Though our unemployment rate is low, too many Vermonters continue to struggle to meet their daily needs. The poverty line for a family of four is set at about $24,500. For a single person, it's about $12,000. 12% of Vermonters live below those lines. Much of the work our state government does is to try to create policies that increase economic sustainability and stability. No one wants people to live in poverty. But philosophies differ about the right approach to prosperity. Are higher taxes and a strong social safety net the right route? Lowering taxes and letting people keep more in their pockets? Lowering corporate tax rates and streamlining permitting to encourage more business growth, more affordable housing units? Having a policy discussion sounds kind of wonky and perhaps even boring until you realize that policy decisions shape our communities, our economies, our futures. Today on the show, we're going to talk about what kinds of policy changes might help. And that's where you come in. Are there actual policy decisions that would make you feel more financially stable? What do you think would actually help if you are feeling yourself, feeling that tightening in your chest when it comes to finances, which so many of us do no matter what category we're actually labeled in? The Public Assets Institute in Montpelier just came out with its annual survey of the economic landscape called the State of Working Vermont 2017. Now, this progressive and left-leaning think tank comes out strong, saying many policymakers are thinking backwards, and new policies that favor strengthening workers as the way to economic prosperity. Joining us to share that perspective today is the president and founder of the Public Assets Institute, Paul Seelow. Paul, nice to have you back.
Thanks, Jane. Nice to be here.
We wanted to balance Paul's take with a more conservative viewpoint as well, so we've called upon UVM economist Art Wolf. Nice to have you back, Art.
Hi, Jane.
Now, the two of you are frequent foils for one another, so this probably feels like a pretty comfortable setup. And I'm interested in your take because, as I said, this idea of policy, you know, people think, oh, God, policy discussions, so boring, until we think about how they affect our actual lives. And really, they do. I mean, certainly they do. So I want to get into that. But before we talk about various policies and policy changes and policy prescriptions, Vermont's poverty rate has been rising since about 2006, when I think there were about 60,000 Vermonters who fell below the poverty line then, about 70,000 Vermonters now, and not, as we know, a significant population increase in the state. Paul Seelow, how does that compare to other states?
Vermont's poverty rate is not the highest in the country. The poverty rate increase that we saw in 2016, I should add that the State of Working Vermont 2017 report is based on the most recent data available, and most of that is from 2016. That in 2016, Vermont was one of just a handful of states that saw an increase in poverty. In part, though, you know, 1 year does not make a trend, and in part, we think that's because the previous year we saw a decline in poverty, and that was it looks like it's a correction. But overall, the trend is clear, as you point out, that over the last 10 years, Vermont's poverty rate has been increasing.
Art Wolf, do you have a theory on why Vermont's trend line is going down despite an improving national economy? And many people would look to things like Vermont's unemployment rate and think an improving state economy as well.
Yeah, I don't put a whole lot of stock in just 1 year's changes. So the increase in 2016, to me, isn't really a big deal. In fact, if you look back over the last 20 years or so, 25 years, our poverty rate really just has bounced around a pretty flat line. It's increased a little bit over the last maybe 5 or 10 years since the recession. But over the longer period of time, it's pretty flat. And in fact, Paul said Vermont's poverty rate is not one of the highest in the country. We're actually one of the lowest in the country. So the way these are measured, by some measures, we are the second lowest. By other measures, maybe the fifth or sixth lowest. So we're way down there. Our poverty problem, and it is a problem, is not nearly as bad as it is in most other states.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough one to swallow if you're somebody living in Vermont, and whether you're living below that poverty line, that technical poverty line, or even quite a bit above it, and really many Vermonters very much higher than the poverty line and struggling to make those end meets and thinking, oh, terrific, we're better than, you know, some of the southern states with, you know, upwards of 20% poverty rates. And yet we're still, you know, 10%, 1 in 10. These are our neighbors. These are us. I mean, people in Vermont are really often struggling. And so, you know, sure, we're doing better than other states, but why aren't we doing even better than that, Art? Why, you know, why are we staying stable in an improving economic, national economic picture?
Yeah, well, you have to look and say, well, why is it that some people earn such low wages? And actually, the lowest wage you can earn, obviously, is zero. And in fact, if you look at the official poverty numbers, the most common reason that people are in poverty is because they don't work at all. So about half the people who are officially poor, they work 0 hours per week and 0 weeks per year. So now they may have very good reasons for that. It may be a single mom staying home with kids. It may be someone who's disabled, someone who's retired, although they should have some Social Security income. So there's lots of reasons. But we have to remember that official poverty, a lot of it is due to lack of work. Now, the people who are above the poverty line are, you know, they're not counted in that 10% number, but they as you mentioned, they still have a lot of economic problems.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. That gets us into some of our policy questions and policy areas already with those questions of, you know, do you help most by putting more money into workers' pockets? Well, not if you're not working, I suppose. But also, let me get to one more sort of baseline point here, data point, and then we can talk about that. Paul, are you seeing, and Art, you can chime in here as well, are you seeing similar either declines or stability in other income areas, or are we seeing this wealth gap widen? So in other words, if we're looking at, you know, 10 and then up to about 12% of people living in poverty in the lowest levels, are middle-income Vermonters also seeing stagnant growth, or are they improving? And are high-income Vermonters stagnant or improving? Paul?
Yeah. One of the things we look at is median household income. And median household income is simply, if you take all the Vermonters and line them up, that it's half of the people would earn less than that and half would earn more. So it's the middle point. And we've, over the last decade, it's been stagnant. Essentially, it's actually down a little bit in 2016 from 2006, but it's up and down, but pretty much it's a flat line for median household income. But when you look at wages and household income by, you know, quintile, in other words, you divide everybody up into fifths and look at who's gaining and who's not gaining, those at the bottom essentially are gaining very little, whereas those at the top are gaining more. The one measure we look at is income growth for the top 1% compared to the remaining 99%. And since the bottom of the recession in June of 2009, the top 1%, the real income growth, in other words, once it's corrected for inflation, has gone up about 24%. And the bottom 99% have gone up 5%. So it's almost 4 or 5 times more growth in real income at the top 1% compared to the rest of the population. So it really is a problem of increasing income inequality, that there's, and Vermont is one of the, and has been for a while, one of the fastest has one of the fastest growing income inequality situations in the country.
All right, I'll give you a chance to respond, but I also want you to just share your basic philosophical approach to the government's role in creating economic prosperity and combating poverty.
Sure. The whole program is about policy, and policies are important, but they're not. In the bigger picture, they're really not all that important. They tinker around the edges.
Okay. See you later. Can go now.
Well, if you look at it, but this does end up leading to some policy issues. If you look at it historically, the major reason why people are not poor is because of economic growth. If you look 200 years ago, everybody in the world was poor. If you look at China in 1980, everybody in China was poor. And today, China has a huge middle class. They have a lot less poverty. If you look at Vermont 50 years ago, 100 years ago, Vermonters were very poor by modern standards. So even poor Vermonters today who have it rough are in a lot better situation than the average Vermonter was 50 or 100 years ago. So we have to remember that economic growth is the major factor that lifts people out of poverty. And we shouldn't lose sight of that. Policies can tinker around the edges. They can also cause poverty to get worse. But that's the main issue. And that to me is kind of my basic philosophy of all this is that you don't want to kill the goose that's laying the golden egg, and the goose is economic growth.
But can't government policy either help to boost economic growth or to throttle it? I mean, isn't that where policy does come in many cases?
And it's a lot easier to throttle it than to goose it. That's the problem. There's all sorts of unanticipated consequences. Policies that may sound good but are just terrible. We can look at Venezuela as a great example of a country that tried to help people and ended up destroying an economy.
And does the minimum wage hike come in here in your brain?
When we think about the minimum wage, we've got to think not just about the short-term effects, which is some people are going to get a higher wage, but we have to think of what it does in the short term to other people, and then what it does in the longer term to maybe discourage firms from creating entry-level jobs that people without a whole lot of skills, and those are people who tend to be poor, people with low education and low skills, we don't want to make it harder for them to get their feet on the bottom rung of that ladder that moves them up in their personal financial health.
Paul Cielo, what about for you, a philosophical approach here to the government's role in all of this, and then you can chime in on the minimum wage as well.
Well, I think I'll start again with or mention again the income inequality. Income inequality is a huge economic problem in the state, actually in the country, but it's looking at it just from the perspective of the state, mainly because what you have is an increasing amount of the state's collective income. In other words, the income of all of us, if you add it all up together, it's about $30 billion currently a year that – when you an increasing amount of that is going into fewer and fewer hands, and that when you have somebody, for example, earning $2 million or have an income of $2 million, they can't spend all of that in Vermont. Whereas if that $2 million was in the hands of 50 households, each with $40,000, that they would be spending that on necessities and keeping the money moving through the economy, which benefits everybody. So it's not a surprise that we would see poverty increasing, that we would see slow economic growth in a place where we have rapidly increasing income inequality. So there is now Art is right in one sense that that there's limits to what policies, particularly at the state level, can do to impact these things. But what I'll mention is that but there are things we can do. It's just that you can't expect to create miracles with it. For example, the Vermont income tax system basically gives away about $100 million a year to the highest income Vermonters through tax credits and exemptions in the system. That doesn't have to be the case. The state doesn't have to have a policy that gives $100 million to the highest income people in the state every year. And at the same time, we have a program, Reach Up, that is for the poorest families in the state with children that is underfunded. Essentially, that is getting less than half of what the state says that these families need to live on. And so I think it's a question of priorities, and we can make changes to these priorities that can make a difference to Vermonters' lives.
Well, and let's get into some of those lives. We have some comments that I'll read. Eli says, what we need is less policies. As government control in Vermont has increased, so has the difficulty in living here. Government policies make everything in this state more expensive and reduce employment opportunities by driving away businesses. Brian says every state needs the same thing: cheaper housing, which includes help paying the bills that go along with housing, and more entry-level jobs that offer a livable wage. We also need food stamps for anyone who needs them and state-sponsored public transportation that is cheap or free. Rachel says the low-income families that I work with find heating season particularly stressful. Assistance kicks in at the end of November, but we live in a state where it's cold well before then. Many families pay for their first heating fuel bill themselves and then fall behind on other bills. Some live paycheck to paycheck but don't qualify for heating assistance. One family qualified for a single fill-up this year, but it's been so cold that they're already out. A minimum delivery that won't even fill the tank costs $400. Most low-income families don't have that kind of extra cash, so they'll stop paying car insurance or use electric space heaters and hope the pipes don't freeze. And let's go to Dan calling in from Waterbury. Hi, Dan. Go right ahead.
Yeah, my thought I wanted to put out there is I moved to Vermont shortly after leaving the military, and I've noticed that one burden here that really hurts a lot of disabled veterans who own homes is the property tax, because a lot of our income is fairly limited, and so that little extra makes a big difference, and it's rough in this state. A lot of other states, especially down south and back west, have a lot of exemptions for veterans with disabilities, but this state has very little going on with that.
Dan, I appreciate your perspective. Thank you for sharing it and how it affects your life. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today we're talking with Art Wolf, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Vermont. His research is focused on issues like taxation and public policy. He's also a former state economist under Governor Madeleine Cunin. And Paul Cielo, president and founder of the Public Assets Institute, based in Montpelier. Paul is a former state representative for the communities of Hardwick, Walden, and Stannard. We were prompted to have this conversation by the new paper put out by the Public Assets Institute looking at poverty and policy. What policies do you think could help pull you into a more stable financial position? So, you know, I know the answer is more money, sure, but how? What's the right approach? Would state-funded child care be good, even if it winds up taking some money out of your paycheck? Would mandating a higher minimum wage give you that more money answer, or do you see it as business killing, potentially losing you your job? I've got a note from Marianne and Cabot who says, when a person who's received welfare is lucky enough to get a job or a raise, it would be good if they could stay on welfare for a few additional months and not have any reductions to their benefits. For example, 6 months could allow them to start paying off debts and actually get on their feet instead of making no progress financially. We should allow people who get a raise or a job to have a few months' grace period to get stabilized before they're on their own again. And on that note, the King Street Center, which is a Burlington nonprofit that helps children and families with preschool and after-school programs, says the benefit cliff is a real issue. We find that parents who start to succeed in the workplace and are offered the chance to earn more often struggle to accept a promotion because all of a sudden they'll lose child care subsidies and other critical supports. That wipes out any financial progress they've made. A tiered or stepped transition plan would be far more effective. Paul Cielo, thoughts on that?
Absolutely. That's correct. The so-called benefit cliff, where people are going from either not working or working part-time for a variety of reasons, and they have or working at a low wage, and they have an opportunity to move up, but in the process they're no longer eligible. If they take the additional money, they're no longer eligible for public benefits, and they put themselves in a worse financial situation. So that's not a viable position for people to be in. And there are solutions to that they require some state resources to do it, but we could solve that problem. It takes the will to do it.
Art Wolf?
Paul, I agree with you completely. one of the problems, when we tend to think about taxes, we always said, what do high taxes do to rich people? When we raise their taxes, is a disincentive for them to earn money and to do productive things. But if you look down at the other end of the income distribution, way down in the bottom, people that try to better themselves by working more hours per week or getting a raise, they face this benefit cliff, which essentially means that a lot of their benefits or different types of benefits are taken away. In effect, that's a tax increase on them. And sometimes those tax rates that they face implicitly are much higher than the taxes we apply on rich people. The problem is that if you didn't do that, it would cost you a lot of money. So as Paul said, it takes resources. But it is a real problem. You want to give low-income people an incentive to better themselves. But the problem is they face very high tax rates. They could lose child care. They could lose housing subsidies. They could lose food stamps. They can lose all sorts of benefits. And they may make an extra $1,000 a month. But if they lose $700 of benefits, that's a pretty high tax rate.
Yeah, you know, I'll put this into a personal context. I was chatting with a friend who is in another state but in a much higher income bracket than I am. And she was trying to compare the rates that she and I both pay for childcare. And she was saying, oh, Vermont childcare rates are so much lower than my childcare rates, so you should have no problem even though you make less money. And it was like, right, but as a percentage of my salary, it's a higher rate than what yours is, even if the actual dollar figure is lower. And when we talk about poverty, whether it's if you look at the rate of sort of free money that people have in their pockets, if it's a percentage, the wealthier people are going to have a lot more money, and groceries cost the same whether you're rich or poor. You know, that gallon of milk does not cost less because you have a lower income. So that question of actual money in your pocket, you know, and the tax rate is a big one. On that, let's go to David, who's calling in from St. Albans. Hi, David.
Hi. I thank you for taking my call. I've been a longtime employer. I've since retired, but I found over my career that my tax rate doesn't have a whole lot of effect on the number of employees that I would hire. It really is based on what my customers demand is, and I found that my customer demand depends on the amount of spending money that consumers have. So it would seem to me that lowering a tax rate for a corporation doesn't necessarily create jobs, but that by increasing a wage to my employees would give them more spendable income and allow them to purchase my products.
So, David, in that case, you'd be in favor of policies that lower the tax rate for lower and moderate income Vermonters, for example?
Yes, I would. Yes.
Thanks. I appreciate that perspective and coming from a business owner looking at, you know, what's the best thing for your business is not necessarily a better tax rate for your business, but perhaps a better tax rate for your customers. Art Wolf, what about this idea? You know, you're talking about tax rates here. You've been sharing with us what you think. But, you know, here's David saying, I don't need a better tax rate for my business. I need more customers.
Yeah, well, Vermont taxes are more focused on individuals through our income tax than really on the corporate taxes we have here. The corporate tax rate in Vermont, whatever it is, I can't recall off the top of my head, but most of that is paid by about 100 corporations. So smaller businesses, they pay a lot of other different types of taxes, unemployment taxes. But what we really should focus on, I think, for kind of economic dynamism is what the income tax rates are. And a lot of Vermonters are concerned about property taxes, and those are very high in Vermont compared to most other states.
Paul Cielo, what do you think?
Well, I think when we talk about taxes, that it's not – you can't just talk about the income tax by itself or the property tax by itself. That within that, it's a question of who's paying at what level. So currently, Vermont overall has a regressive tax system. When you look at Vermont's – we have a progressive income tax, which means that the highest payers pay a higher percentage of their income than the lowest income income filers. But overall, when you combine sales tax, property taxes, and other taxes, overall our system is regressive, meaning that those at the low income or middle income pay a higher percentage of their income than those at the top. So I think we could change the profile of Vermont's tax system and make it more progressive, and that would actually benefit low and moderate income Vermonters. So and I think that would be an appropriate response to the income inequality problem in the state and would have a positive economic effect.
let's talk, you know, I mentioned childcare costs. This is one that we heard about a lot in the last election cycle, certainly in the race for governor, questions about affordable childcare, available childcare in Vermont, and then subsidies. So some families receive subsidies, some don't. If your child is in preschool at the age of three, you can get a state subsidy that goes to the preschool. What's the right solution for childcare, which affects, you know, Vermonters of all different income levels, but can certainly be a barrier to work or to better work? Art Wolf, you know, should the state just be funding childcare?
I don't think we could afford it. Just like I don't think we could afford Paul's suggestion that we just raise taxes on higher income people, because our taxes on high income people are already one of the highest in the country.
And you don't think we could afford that because people would leave, you mean?
Yeah, they have options. That's right. Or they would just start businesses elsewhere or just never come, which is kind of the same thing. But with childcare, I think there's a lot to be said for subsidizing childcare for low-income families who really have a hard time paying. As you said, the price of childcare is the same whether you make $20,000 a year or $100,000 a year or more. So I think there's something to be said for that. The problem is if you start subsidizing childcare for everybody, it turns into a subsidy to the middle class and to upper income people. And unfortunately, many state programs that begin, or federal programs as well, that begin as an attempt to try to help low income people really end up helping the middle class and wealthier people, and therefore are very, very expensive. So I think you have to be very careful when you're designing and implementing programs like that, as good as they might be, and as you know, in terms of having outcomes that you desire.
Paul Cielo, what's your perspective on that?
Well, first of all, I want to comment on Art's mentioning about people leaving or not coming to Vermont, and just to put that in perspective, there's very little churn overall in the number of people going to a state or coming from a state, and all of the studies suggest that taxes are very low on the list in terms of making those decisions. So I just think that we need to put that in perspective. In terms of the discussion about services like childcare, I think we should be moving toward thinking about childcare as a public good. And the reason I say that is that for families to be able to work, they need, and particularly if you want to have both, if you have a two-parent family or two-parent household, if both parents want to work, they have to have high-quality child care that they can afford. And otherwise, that you're either going to get one person that works, or if it's a single parent, it's going to be a difficult situation for them to find child care or pay for it. So I think we need to think of it as an economic development issue that we have, and if we want to attract young people with young families to Vermont, we need to be able to have services that Vermonters need. One thing I'll point out is that, you know, we have a public education system that everyone takes advantage of, regardless of their income. And we do that because we value public education. We know it's essential to a democratic society. I think that childcare is, it may not be at the same level as public education, but it's an important public good that the state needs to have take seriously and make sure that is available to all Vermonters.
Let's go to Andrea, who's calling in from Plainfield. Hi, Andrea. Go right ahead.
Hi. Good morning. This is Andrea from Plainfield. I totally support what the former gentleman mentioned about child care as a total good for the whole society and attractive for others to come. And to somehow make it more available, more affordable. I would like to point out that I'm strongly feeling income tax has to be the one paying for our schools, not property tax. Seeing my three older, very well-educated daughters having to either live in Oregon than in Vermont, because the income tax for a 40-acre beautiful ranch is their $400 a year, while here for 15 acres outside of town in Plainfield, it's over $5,000. That is really hard to take.
Andrea, I take your point. So you'd like to see more pressure on the income tax and less pressure on property taxes. Leonard is calling in from Hanover. I think we've got Leonard back. Go right ahead.
Yes, I'm back.
Great.
Thank you for taking the call. I am interested in the guests' opinions about the prevailing culture in Vermont, the underlying thinking that prevents or impedes or advances the kinds of policies you're talking about. Appear to be areas in Vermont that are doing very well, like the country at large, and areas that are lacking the ability to attract the kind of economic incentives and development that that it already exists in many places in Vermont.
So, Leonard, what do you see as the culture here? When you say that word, what do you mean? What are you thinking of?
I mean the underlying values, the mind frames, particularly in local areas where the councils and the municipal and town governments are run by people who don't necessarily have the same interests as the people who see the state at large. There are different perspectives on these problems. Those perspectives certainly require local cooperation and local input, but it seems to me that they are so atomized at the local level that it's very difficult to develop a set of state values that would support the kinds of policies that you're talking about.
Leonard, thanks for your call. Let me put that to Paul Cielo. Do you see cultural attitudes at the local level shaping economic prosperity at the local level?
Well, I think, first of all, the local communities have been faced with a lot of challenges that have been sort of kicked down from the federal government, from the state government to the local communities. And they sort of, you know, it's sort of the last stop in terms of a government sector that to deal with social issues. So I do think it's challenging at the community level. I should say that, you know, one of the reasons we published the State of Working Vermont report is to provide some indicators of whether we're making progress or not. And because I think if we're – I have – you know, I grew up in Vermont. I've lived here my entire life. I feel that Vermonters actually want things to work. And I don't feel at all cynical about Vermonters' desire for things to work. But I think what you have to have in front of you is, are things working? Are they not working? What kind of policies could we put in place? Or we've tried these. They don't work. Let's try something different. That I think that getting these using these indicators like the poverty rate, for example, if it's moving in the wrong direction, how do we get it to move in the other direction? I think these are the fundamental questions. If affordability for families with children is becoming a bigger problem, how do we move that in the other direction? That should be the standard that the legislature is using and actually allowing communities to help with that process. And I'd like to see actually the move toward, and there is some movement in this direction, of having indicators at the community level so that communities get a signal about how their community, their county is doing and can actually step in and take action.
So, you know, this is – I find these conversations both interesting and challenging because there's so much to talk about and you sort of scratch the surface and then wish you could have gone deeper in some areas but leave out others. And so I know this is a little bit unfair, but Art Wolf, are there – you know, can you bullet point for us? You know, is there like the best bang for our buck is here, not here, take out this part and put in this part, and that's what you think would not be the ticket, not be the magic bullet, but –
Yeah, with the knowledge that any policy you undertake is probably going to cost money. So you want to try to minimize the cost and maximize the benefit.
Right.
So one of the best programs for what we started talking about was poverty, is the Earned Income Tax Credit, which Vermont is one of the first states to piggyback to the federal one. Basically, it means that if you're low income and you work, the state and the federal government as well will essentially subsidize your wage. They'll give you money back on your when you file your income taxes. So it's a wage subsidy. And if you put those two together, it amounts to as much as $4 an hour for a low-wage worker. So it's a lot. You can always increase it.
All right. So Earned Income Tax Credit, really key there in that. Paul Cielo, is there something that you point to? I mean, I know there are a lot of policy prescriptions, but that idea of, you know, biggest bang for our buck.
Well, first of all, I agree with Art on the Earned Income Tax Credit. That's one of the areas, you know, that we have agreed upon for as long as I know. But I also think we need to increase this minimum wage, essentially what the Earned Income Tax Credit does is it, as Art mentioned, it's essentially a state subsidy of low wage employers. And what we need to do is bring up those lower wages, and also I think modify the Earned Income Tax Credit so that there's more that the it doesn't cut the benefits to the individuals who are actually getting a higher wage.
Boy, as I said, really scratching the surface, certainly more to come on so many of these issues, including, of course, this conversation being had at the legislative level again about the increasing the minimum wage. But Art and Paul, thank you both very much for sharing your expertise on this sort of high above conversation about policy and poverty. Thank you.
You're welcome. Pleasure to be here.
Art Wolf is an associate professor of economics at the University of Vermont. Paul Cielo is the president and founder of the Public Assets Institute. This is Vermont Edition.